Blog Talk Radio.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a steno pad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Well, good morning, everyone. It's Friday, September 9th. I didn't expect we had that commercial on. I must have made a mistake when I activated for this particular program. But our phone contact is actually 347-415-4326. So 347-415-4326. And I guess that's the case. Well, we are expecting to speak with none other than New York State Assembly member, Nader Sayers. He represents the Yonkers. Totally, his whole district is comprised of Yonkers, yet it's only 85% of the city that he represents, and that's the Assembly District 90. And very unusual, because I don't think there is any other community that only has an Assembly member that represents only one particular city. And Yonkers is the third largest city in the state. Well, we are expecting a call from the Assembly member. And before we get started, because he hasn't called in yet, I guess there must be a reason for it. What I found interesting is we have comments that can be posted on our website. And we get many, many, many comments. But sometimes I find that the comments are, I don't know, vacuous, because they don't explain themselves. They're not all there. And hold on a second. Bear with me a moment here, because we're getting a call. One second. Let's see, I hope I'm getting this right. Almost got something wrong. Do I need to do this again? Forgive me. All right, so hopefully this will work. Well, so one thing that I've learned is there was some interesting comment yesterday, or was the day before, that I saw that questioned the integrity of our elected officials, in the sense that it was believed or espoused by this particular commenter. There were two or three times they had posted it, because it seems like the same language and certainly the same demeanor. The question became in my mind, and I see our guest is coming on in a moment. He's already on the line, so we'll hold the line for Nader Sayers. So what was very interesting, the commentator had suggested that the people in our elected office really don't do any work, as if they just sit there and do what? I don't know where this comes from, but it's so ignorant that one of the questions that I want to pose to Nader Sayers, because he's already on the line, I want to ask him about the process. So let's bring him in, because he's on the line right now. Bear with me a second as I try to pull him in.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Hezzy.
How are you? What a pleasure to speak to you. I'm so excited.
We're glad to be on the show again, Hezzy, and we're glad you're feeling well, and your health and your well-being and your involvement is crucial, you know, because you're one of the main voices that promotes awareness and really allows us an opportunity to get into the issues and get into the concerns that impact us here in Yonkers and Westchester and the entire state. So always a pleasure to be on the show, Hezzy.
Well, thank you. Well, what a pleasure. Thank you for the accolades. I don't know if I deserve them all, but I'll have to live up to them, that's for sure. You know what I found really interesting? As you well know, on the website, we have room for people to comment. And even though the comments were made, if I remember correctly, I just trashed them. Because the statement, and there were three of them, that repeated the same line or the same thinking process. And what they suggested was that people in elected office, whether in the Assembly or whether in the Senate, are just tools of a higher process, and that they just follow orders. And they're really not creative at all. And what I would love for you to explain, because even I am certain that I'm not fully aware of the process, because I've never been to the Assembly or to the New York State Senate and looked at the process and listened to it and recognize how legislation is formulated and how one goes about bringing consensus so that you can get a majority, whether from one party or the next. And would you explain that? Because I'm tired of people who are ignorant, who have an opinion.
You know, I mean, you're right. To your point, when the process that we have, fortunately, in America and our government, a process that is, that is really the standard of democracy. Democracy is key for the electorate, the regular people, common people, to say, hey, who best can represent us? And we have a structure of government where we have local representatives, county, state representatives, federal representatives, and each level of government has a responsibility to the people they represent. And the way government is set up, there's checks and balances, there's an understanding, there's a rule through the Constitution that balances local, state, federal powers and duties and responsibilities. And as an elected official, we as elected officials are basically individuals that come from many different forms of life. You know, I'm an educator, I'm an attorney. You know, so for me, I sought public office to lobby initially for education, for equity, for quality of life, for preserving middle class, tax breaks, and so forth. So every individual that gets elected, you know, has a theme, has a philosophy on what they believe, what they don't believe, and that's what makes us great as a democracy. And I say to people that have issues with public officials or issues, when they complain, I've learned over the years, you know, to take some very seriously. Even though I may disagree with someone that may make a comment that, you know, I may perceive as negative, but if it has merits and the complaint or the comment or the remark is such where, you know, they have a basis to say, hey, you voted on this, and, you know, I don't see why you did, and this is how I believe, and this is why you're wrong, and this is why you should be different. I'll respect that, and I'll comment, and sometimes, you know, we'll modify the way we think, the way we vote. But to your point, when individuals have a blanket negative remark and they have no substance behind it, you know, then it could be either personal, it could be just, you know, a intentional defamation of someone's character, somebody's persona, somebody's policies. You know, you learn to ignore those type of remarks because, again, they're not targeted to a real issue where someone is trying to make things better. It's like someone who makes it their business to say, you know what, I'm going to be negative, I'm going to be controversial, no matter what the person does. Sometimes they may not even know who the person is, and they attack a person's credibility. Then, you know, then that's unjust. In many ways, that can even be illegal. It could be criminal. If someone, for example, knowingly goes out of their way to defame someone, even if they're a public official, an elected official, that's wrong. And the law doesn't allow you to intentionally go out and say, you know what, even though I know this is wrong and this is untruthful, but I'm going to say it and I'm going to accuse just because I want to harm someone, you know, then you're crossing the line. Now, having said that, I got to say, you know, for me, there's many issues, you know, that sometimes, yes, they're controversial. I may have a personal opinion about it. But if I represent the city of Yonkers and I represent, you know, a huge constituent base, I'm going to see how they feel. And the way I do it is by communicating. We have a newsletter that goes out, you know, digital weekly. Mm-hmm. We have a social media campaign. We basically go out and I meet a lot of people. I attend a lot of events. I attend a lot of conferences, civic and governmental. And my role is to listen to what people have to say as a public official and to really see how they feel. And if I feel on a certain issue that 80% of people feel a certain way, then to a large extent, my voting record and my policies and my statements would have to reflect. Otherwise, why am I representing a constituent base when I don't really protect their best interest? And their best interest, you know, is how the majority, a super majority of them feel. Like we took strong issues on gun legislation. We took strong issues on women's rights, for example. And I know when I go around, 80% of people solidly want to protect women's rights, you know, their health concerns. Mm-hmm. And some people are against it. But you can't satisfy everyone. So if somebody has a negative opinion about an issue, whether it's vaccination or women's rights or gun legislation, you know, they may attack you because, well, I disagree with the politician or the public official on this issue. But honestly, at the end of the day, if somebody's reasonable, then they should look at the overall person. They should look at their track record. They should look at their voting record. And they should look at what they're able to produce in general. But if they start targeting, you know, one factor, one issue, that's where it becomes really, in my opinion, wrong. That's not the purpose of democracy in the best way possible, and that's where the changes take place. That's my interpretation of that, Hezzy.
Well, I would concur with what you've said in entirety. I find that, I guess, unfortunately, we have to serve two aspects on the website. One, we need to give people anonymity because there can be ramifications if one signs their name or it's forced to expose who they are. And on the other hand, it's also, if that's the case and we protect people by not necessarily posting their name or attributing a comment to them, then they also have to be responsible to to conform to guidelines of respect, also
correct,
to speak to honestly about an issue. If they've got a concern, they need to explain it. They need to not insinuate, but actually validate what they're saying, which I find is evidently missing quite often. And I've gotten tired of accepting that. I don't think I've accepted it for a very long time, but I'm tired of being inundated with innuendo and insinuation that is not validated, and you can't even move in that direction. But I think what I find difficult is that people who have never been to the New York State Assembly or the chambers of the New York State Senate, or even maybe witnessing our government here in the city of Yonkers. We have a city council too.
Correct.
And I don't know if they actually listen or if they're aware of what's being discussed. So it's so difficult to think that you've got like seven people who sit on the Yonkers City Council, for example. They're not all hacks. They're not listening to one voice. They've all got different opinions. And the idea is to bring them together on a particular issue. So the issue is what it is. And then everyone comments or may concur with the intention of new legislation. And I don't know why, outside of the local arena, because even so many people are even ignorant of what's happening locally, that they think they can define what's happening up in Albany or
right,
in Washington, D.C. It's just amazing. But I, at the end, in hearing you again, and I try to listen to people and what they say and to think of it from a positive light rather than to undermine our elected officials. But too often I think of that last, because I think at the end there's a lot of attempts and effort to undermine our elected officials without validating what the critique is. And I find that offensive.
Right. Now, having said that, I agree that the way our system, our political system, and people run for re-election, people, that do things that are wrong or help to the standard of the law, I'm a big advocate of that. And, what we said earlier, it's something that I believe in as a public official. It's my track record. But also, there is, unfortunately, public officials at all levels of government that, in my opinion, and I'm sure in the opinion of many in the community, feel that they haven't really lived up to the standard. And I agree, there's many public officials at all levels that really don't fulfill their duties, what I consider their fiduciary duty to represent the best interests. And that's why we have a system where if a politician, your representative, is not doing what they should be doing, and they've been there a while, whether it's local, state, county, federal, then vote them out. That's the beauty of our democracy. But do it on the basis of truly, as you said, if it's local candidates, go to the city council meetings, listen to the meetings, look at the agendas, look at the voting records, look at what the statements and the follow-through. If a candidate, for example, doesn't follow through, doesn't support initiatives that are important for their community, then hold them accountable. And election time, that's the purpose of elections, for people to get out and say, hey, I gave you a chance, I voted for you, but looking at what you've done for X amount of years, some individuals, that still run for office might have served 10 years on local government, and you look at their track record and they've done nothing. They've done nothing potential.
They
you
talk.
Know, that's something that the public should look at and say, wait a minute. What do you mean give you another chance? You've been around 10 years. You haven't done anything. Why should I give you
mm-hmm.
another chance? Then you look at someone else who within a short time has produced and has brought fund in and has initiated legislation that has an impact, not only local, but statewide. Then that's something that, for example, you look at and you say, you know what? I don't care what political party this person is. And I may agree, you know, with issues this person stands for. And I may disagree with some issues this person stands for. But you know
mm-hmm.
what? At the end of the day, I'm going to truly look at the candidate and say, you know what? In general, this person is positive and this person deserves my support. And that's how the process best works. But as we started the show earlier, unfortunately, there's individuals that have a motive, that have a mission just to be negative, to be on attack mode, no matter what the person does. Well, how can I spin it in a negative way? And how can I defame the person? And, you know, that's where it becomes vicious, it becomes wrong. And I've learned, honestly, how to ignore a lot of that negative and focus on the positive. What I'm proud of is my track record of, you know, being proactive, focusing on a lot of local issues, some of them state, even recently. Recently, you know, with 9/11 victims, that's something that
mm-hmm.
is beyond Yonkers, beyond Westchester, even beyond New York State, even
right.
international, the whole issue of 9/11, the World Trade Center. We're on the verge of the 21st anniversary. 21 years ago, when the World Trade
wow.
Center buildings were attacked, and that day I'll never forget. You know, as a school principal in Yonkers,
mm-hmm.
and being at a conference when this took place, and being able to see the smoke of the towers when the towers were hit, and just recently, we proposed major legislation that I call the 9/11 Notice Act, and that's to find forgotten victims of the World Trade Center terrorist attack. 21 years later, you know, we all know we lost some 3,000 fellow New Yorkers and citizens
yeah.
that day. It was tragic. But what people don't realize, nearly 5,000 people since then have died from 9/11 related illnesses, from cancer,
correct.
From respiratory mm-hmm. disease. You know, and that is so terrible. And that's something, for example, that something I, as a public official, you know, looked at and said, you know, that there's a serious problem there, you know. And what amounted there was when we looked at the data, and then I put on my principal's hat on, for example, as an
mm-hmm.
educator,
yeah.
when somebody shows you a 90% score, you say, wow, you know, they did academically well. That's a standard where 90% passed sufficiency, they did well. You know, we realized when it came to 9/11, and it came to the victim compensation funds that were available and the healthcare benefits that were available, people that were involved with labor unions, namely police, fire, EMS, these individuals, due to the credit of the labor unions, were given proper notice of their rights. They were told, hey, you know, the pollution and the dust from 9/11 was terrible. And
mm-hmm.
you're entitled to compensation, and this is the way you register, and this is the way you protect yourself and your family. 90% compliance was successful. And then you
correct.
Realize when you look at general civilians and you look at the rest of individuals, the people that cleaned up the 9/11 site, you know, the construction workers, the people that
mm-hmm.
went to school at area Midtown Manhattan, that prayed
yeah.
in that area, that had businesses, insurance companies, financial companies, you know, you realize these are individuals, the Environmental Protection Agency right away told these individuals, oh, the air is safe, you can go back to work there. And these people went back to work not knowing that the air was not safe, you know, that there was so many pollutants, you know, from the 9/11 attack that circulated.
Right.
Now we know from September, from the attack date in 2001, 8 months later, till May of 2002, that those 8 month period, that the pollution was so bad that it was dangerous. It caused cancer, respiratory illness, disease, and a lot of other diseases. So, you know, we made a major mistake. You know, we told people it's safe to go back. And now the problem is, we spoke earlier about the 90% with labor that were compliant. I started to do research. I wanted to know, aside from the union people and the first responders, what about the general public? Are they aware of their rights? Were they encouraged to register and protect their interests? Then you realize...
I don't think they were.
10%. I mean, again, as a school principal, you know, when you have a 10% pass rate, that's a failing grade. That's terrible, right?
Exactly. Yes.
So, you know, so what we did, we drafted legislation, and legislation that's called the 9/11 Notice Act. And that's basically to pass legislation that would require corporations with 50 employees or more to give notice. Sometimes all it requires is a phone call or a stamp on a letter to basically give notice to their employees, whether past or present, retirees, even people that were impacted with illnesses that don't know that, hey, there's a funding source. There's like $10 billion federal funds for the 9/11 victims, and all people have to do is go and online 911victims.com. I mean, it's very simple. I went on the site, and it's just very simple. It asks for your name, your information, you know, where you worked, where you lived, you know, why were you New York City during that 8 month period, downtown New York, and how you might have been impacted. And even if somebody is not even sick yet, they may be sick. And as time goes on, you lose witnesses, you lose records, you know, companies go out of order, out of business.
I
tell everyone, if you're down there, protect yourself, register. And as long as you're registered, whether, God forbid, you're ill or you may be ill, then you can protect yourself. Not everybody has a good health plan, has he? A lot of people, you know, don't have good plans where there's big deductibles, there's restrictions on their medical. I mean, this can cause a bankruptcy for many individuals. You know, the cost could be on the average up to $50,000 a year. And many people end up getting seriously ill, the impact on their families, because they have nowhere to turn. So this is really, to a large extent, you know, an initiative to say, hey, let's protect the victims. Let's make sure that, you know, we let them know that help is available, health care is free. You know, let's find for what I consider forgotten victims of 9/11. And let's make sure the 9/11 Notice Act will make people remember that access to free health care is available if they register. And, you know, a lot of people don't know that when it became obvious that the toxins were so dangerous, there was a major lawsuit, there was a major initiative, and it took place really when New York City that died as a result of 9/11 ailments. His name was James Zadroga. And, you know,
that was the name of the legislation as well, wasn't it? Zadroga.
Yeah, that's the name. Yeah, it was named after James Zadroga, and it became the victims' compensation for 9/11. And many people have benefited from it. You know, many people have benefited, but again, predominantly first responders, union people. So this legislation really protects the forgotten. And I was at a press conference this past Wednesday with many local and state representatives, labor leaders, and a lot of legal representatives that have represented this population. And, you know, listened to many statements. One young lady, and I was very proud of her to come up and speak, you know, a Mrs. Vigo, you know, who basically worked for a company downtown New York, you know, I think an insurance company. And she was telling us that there was like 15 employees that worked with her, fellow employees, and seven of them became very sick with cancer. I mean, when 50% are sick and have cancer and other ailments as a result of 9/11, it tells you something. And then of the seven, I believe she said three or four of them died already. You know, and this person was in tears, and she herself has cancer, and she's getting treatment. Fortunately, she registered, you know, for the 9/11 victims comp, you know, and protecting herself. But how many people don't know? You know, if she's part of that 10% that's signed up already, you know, what do we do? We sit back 21 years later and say, well, you know what, forget about it. That's nonsense. So this is a type of legislation that, you know, when you talk about somebody, a representative being proactive, this is a display of being proactive. This is something that is beyond Yonkers, New York. You know, people say, well, you represent Yonkers, you know, stay to the business of Yonkers. You know, we're state representatives as a New York State Assemblyman. You know, so yes, I represent Yonkers, and anyone that follows, you know, my nearly 4 years in office, I was elected in 2018, you know, and you look at, you know, what the success rate in funding in services to deal with flooding and mitigation of flooding issues in Yonkers as a result of hurricanes, funding for education, for hospitals, for healthcare. You know, I can be proud of that, and I can say, you know what, I'm out there. I listen to what the people have to say. You know, I follow my experience as an educator for 40 years, and I know that, you know, a lot of children are left behind, especially with the pandemic. We learned with the pandemic that no matter what people tell you, there was a lot of loss of instruction the last couple of years. You know, you know, we improvised and we, you know, we did online learning and, you know, all that is good and dandy as a filling gap. But the bottom line is, you know, I'm not misled. I know for sure, and people that are reasonable know for sure, that there was a lot of lost instruction at all levels. So the answer is, you know, let's improve our technology. Let's make sure parents at home, in the event we got to restore, you know, this online learning, that teachers are better prepared to teach online, that students and their families have internet access, that they have the technology, have the training. You know, let's be prepared. Let's not get caught off guard. I mean, 9/11 taught us a lesson. As Americans, we were caught off guard. You know, that was a real shame on us, you know, but we also learned how to stick together. We learned how to be patriotic. We learned how to be proud. We learned that, you know, the way to go through this was, you know, to protect ourselves and make sure we protect our borders, make sure we protect our, you know, military and our capabilities and our security systems and so forth. You know, that's the hope. The pandemic, as bad as it was, taught us to protect ourselves by making sure we have American-made products, our vaccinations, our medicine, our other important items are not produced elsewhere. So you know, the government.
Well, you know,
what's
interesting about everything that you're saying, and I'm listening intently, not because I'm not thinking, but do people recognize that this doesn't happen on its own? You've got to think about what's pertinent. Then once you conceptualize what needs to be done, because it's been 21 years and it's been forgotten, but you have a history and a knowledge and you've studied, so you can bring these issues forward because you have a sensitivity to it and you know that there's a need for it. But then once you have that as an individual, you also have to engage your comrades in the same house of the assembly on the state level, and likewise the senators in the New York State Senate. So this is not an easy task. So you've got to convince people to the validity of your thinking and the value of your remedy, or how you expect to ameliorate many of these issues. And why is it that people don't understand that? How do they think this happens?
Well, you know, normally when a public official, no matter what their party affiliation, gets elected, they represent everyone. And the public needs to realize, hey, you know, I might have voted for someone different from who now is elected, but you know what? Mm-hmm. Once they're elected, they're my representative. If I have an issue, I'm going to reach out to them, to their staff. You know, I have a weekly digital newsletter that goes out, you know, every single week that indicates, you know, benefits are available, what services, mm-hmm. what has taken place, so that people are aware. And we often say, you know, when we put out information about middle-class homeowners getting rebate checks up to $1,000, that was part of, you mm-hmm. know, trying to help the middle-class property owners. You know, we made sure people that did not receive had an access to find out why is there a delay. And we gave them our number. Ours took on numerous calls, our assembly staff in Yonkers, to basically mm-hmm. help people find out, you know, most people fortunately got their checks. Most people that had issues with unemployment during the pandemic and afterwards, people that put in small business applications, people that had flood issues, even people that had issues with statewide and federal agencies, you know, we got involved. We basically said, you know what, if you need that extra push, if somebody's not getting back to you in a timely fashion, how can we help? And we even took care of a major building complex in Yonkers that, for example, had deteriorated balconies. And they were worried about, you know, concrete from the balconies falling, possibly not only harm, and possibly killing a person if a piece of concrete fell. We reached out to local government and had that issue resolved. We had a major complex in Yonkers that had a serious problem with flooding. They had a serious problem with once the state had utilized part of their grounds and now there was mm-hmm. no need for it. They left it dirty and they left it, you know, uncleaned and stuff. And we got involved and got it cleaned up and restored and given back to the homeowners group there, and resolve parking issues and other matters. That's the type of things where if you're doing your job as a public official, then that's the type of things you should be doing. You should be there representing the people, voting on issues, dealing with constituent matters, promoting more intergovernment collaboration. I don't want to hear a public official that tells you, well, you know, don't complain to me, that's there. Don't complain here, that's not my issue. That's this. you know, my staff is trained to say, hey, tell us what your issue is, and let's see if we can help you. And if it's something that we need to get the congressional office or the U.S. Senate, because it's a federal agency, then you know what? We're going to help you make the call. We're going to identify which office, which individual. If it's a statewide issue, we'll do that. If it's a local or county, we'll do that. That's effective government. And again, the public listening shouldn't look at a person and say, well, I'm against someone because he's a Republican or he's a Democrat or he's whatever the party affiliation is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can support a person because their platform generally is reflective of, you know, the political party they belong to. But at the end of the day, you know, to criticize and attack individuals and defame people, you know, without really knowing the substance behind who this candidate is or who this office holder is really where it becomes wrong, you know. And
absolutely.
I'd like to...
How do people reach out to your office? How do people reach out to your office when they have issues?
You know, I have an assembly office in Albany, you know, where we
mm-hmm.
deal with a lot of the legislative matters. And my constituent office is at 35 East Grassy Sprain Road, off Tuckahoe Road.
Mm-hmm.
The office there is 914-779-8805. And, you know, we're generally there 5 days a week, at least 9 to 5. And
mm-hmm.
I got to say, you know, I consider the office a very active, vibrant office. You know, my staff understands the importance of being proactive and being constituent oriented. And that's what the plan is. You know, to your point, legislation requires, you know, outreach, requires a personality that, you know, puts political affiliations aside and reaches out
mm-hmm.
to members both sides of the aisle up in the assembly. And that's what I've done. I mean, recently, in 1 week, I had the governor sign 3 SAGE bills, you know, and all of them were passed unanimously by the assembly and the Senate. They became law. You know, one of them as simple as, you know, diaper tax relief. You know, so many families and mothers that, you know, during the past year or so, you know, reached out complaining about that they can't afford diapers. That, you know, one third, we think it's not an issue, but one third of mothers were having trouble finding the proper financial resources to have
mm-hmm.
a dry, clean diaper on their kid. Even many disabled, older individuals that, you know, that couldn't afford diapers because of the cost. And then the extra cost of taxation. So the SAGE diaper bill, you know, forbids any municipality, any local government, anyone from adding taxes. Even in our city of Yonkers, they had nearly a 5% tax on diapers. So we got rid of that. And by getting rid of that, in my opinion, it brings relief. You know, we know the inflation has had a major impact on us. Many of us are suffering with the prices of gasoline, the prices of food, you know, the increase, you know, many people that are living on a set salary, you know, can't sustain that. They're having a serious, serious problem. We're not talking about just the poor. You're talking about middle class in New York State, in Yonkers, that are having a hard time between paying their mortgage, paying their taxes, paying their utilities, their water bills. And then you see your shopping bill double in the last 2 years, and then gas,
exactly.
You know, nearly double. Fortunately, we had the gasoline tax relief also. Prices, you know, now are below the $4. You can find
mm-hmm.
gas in Yonkers. Even 371, 377.
Yeah.
You know, thank God it's coming down. And a lot of it has to do with federal outreach, even though we're very critical of the federal government. But the federal government has taken, in my opinion, strong initiatives whether it's through Senator Chuck Schumer, who's the majority leader, you know, bringing funds, the relief packages. Yes, we all know, you know, some of that causes inflation, you know, but you got to find a balance in. When the president went abroad and negotiated and had foreign oil producers produce more oil, you know, people were critical. So, you know, I look at the big picture and I say, you know what, there may be rights and wrong in anything we do, whether federal, state, local, but you got to look at the end result. You got to look at the best interest. And for somebody that wants to complain and be critical, you'll always find a reason to be critical. You know, the same individual that criticize the president for reaching out globally to help resolve the oil crisis were the same people complaining, why are we paying $5 a gallon for gas? You know, so yes, there's political consequences, but that same individual wouldn't acknowledge that gas went below $4 because of that initiative, you know. So, and then you look at legislation and bills. You know, I myself, although I'm a Democrat, you know, I sometimes have concerns. I sometimes don't agree with sometimes issues or platforms that, in my opinion, may be too much to the left or too much to the right. And I've always been in that bit of, As a government, as a people, we got to try to be as mainstream as possible. You know, our country, and we've witnessed this, and we spoke about this, has become so polarized, the division, the political division, you know, that has been so widespread to the point where, you know, there's almost hate, and politics in America wasn't intended to get to that level. You know, as I said earlier on the show, you know, people run on party platforms and party lines. At the end of the day, people that are elect us, we trust them, we basically support them, and we communicate with them, and we, you know, because they become our representatives. And then when the new time to elect comes, then we decide, as we said, is this person deserving of my vote for reelection? And if not, let's bring, and I'm a big advocate of change when change is necessary and change is justifiable. But for those that are criticizing just basically on the basis of philosophy, that's where it becomes wrong. Our nation needs to get back together. You know, we've lost a lot of that patriotism, you know, that we had after 9/11. You know, we were a proud country. You know, we felt a sense of unity as a people to really join together and protect ourselves moving forward. We've lost some of that. And as a public official, you know, what I'll do is I'll continue to reach out to the other side of the aisle. I'll continue to make sure that the voices of everyone are heard. You know, I'm running for re-election this November 8th. I even have my campaign headquarters kickoff, the opening tomorrow from 11 to 1 at it's at office building adjacent to Mount Olympus Diner on Fort Hill Road and Central Avenue.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so please come, and anyone listening, feel free to come. We'll have some refreshments, and we'll get a chance to listen to some of the elected officials there and to basically kick off the election. You know, I'm running an aggressive campaign. I'm running an election on the basis of my track record in less than 4 years, what I've delivered for Yonkers, what I've accomplished, something that I'm very proud of. And that's why I feel.
And I think Yonkers is also proud of what you've accomplished. I think that's why, in a sense, the naysayers are there because they want to undermine rather than to extol what you've accomplished. And maybe if they want to be critical, they could say, "Well, you haven't engaged on this issue or that issue," you know, to inform But that's the whole thing, too. You're a member of a lot of other assembly people. How do you bring them forward on some of the concepts that you think about? Is it just simply espousing it when you are there at the New York State Assembly and you say, I've got something to present? And then they, do you need to bend their arm or do you just need to validate your concept verbally? Is that sufficient? Is that how it works? Or do you have to become friends?
It's a combination of, effective outreach. I've always been a communicator. I've always been a consensus builder. I've always been someone that respected every individual. And people saw that in you. And I'm from the old school of thought, you know, respect people as you would want to be respected. And that passes on. So, you know, when you're holding yourself out as a professional, as someone that, you know, when you speak, when you propose, when you state, you do so with facts, you do so on the basis of a real need, a real concern, and you express that to your colleagues, as I do. I reach out and I tell people, hey, this is an issue we have, not only a Yonkers issue, it's a statewide issue, and this is why it's wrong, why it's good, and this is why it needs to be changed or modified. What do you think? And sometimes, very often, the other side of the aisle may say, Sage, we like your bill, but, you know, can we just tweet it because we're a little bit concerned about this language in the legislation or the bill or this concern? And very often, if it makes sense, and many times, honestly, by communicating and having open dialogue, you know, I'll look at something, look at a proposal they're making, a counter proposal, and say, you know, that makes sense. I agree. Thanks a lot. Makes sense. And I'll modify it and go back and say, well, how is it now? And they'll look at it and say, you know what? You know, thank you very much. You know, this doesn't take place too often, but we appreciate that, you know, we had this dialogue and you gave us an opportunity to give you our opinion and make some potential changes that are helpful or beneficial. So you know what? We're going to support this unit.
Well, you know, I think what you're saying is very, very logical, but it's been somehow eclipsed by our political divide. And what's fascinating is that when you really reflect back historically, not just from the last 4 years, but the last 50 years or 100 years, in reality, even though we have basically two parties, two major parties, Republican and Democrat, there's Democrat or Republican, however you want to define the two parties, and there are a few smaller parties there. But what's interesting is there that much of a difference between them? And I question whether there is that much, because I think in the majority parties of the two largest ones are very similar in their concept, in their construct, and in their thinking. And there might be some changes now, here and there, but that's part of the evolution, isn't it? So it's so difficult if we talk.
But you're right, Hezzy. You know, to your point, American political spectrum has always been where, you know, when you look at mainstream, and we spoke earlier about mainstream America, mainstream politics, you know, Republicans or Democrats, you know, that fall within what I consider this, at the very least, 70%, you know, of our nation, that falls into that mainstream, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you know, to a large extent, there's common agendas of you want to protect the working people, you want to protect the middle class, you want to protect immigrants, you want to protect the working individual that has to pay health care and taxes and fringe benefits and so forth. You know, there's that mainstream that 75% of us live with and we understand. The problem is that we've allowed that mainstream to shift left and right to the 15% that, in my opinion, you know, are maybe, you know, ultra-leftists or to a large extent socialists that want to convert New York State and the nation to a socialistic society. I'm against that.
Mm-hmm.
But then on the other side, you have that 15% that are so ultra-conservative, you know, the whole Tea Party philosophy and so forth, that wanted to drag the nation to the extreme right, and that's wrong too. You know, so, you know, to your point, there really isn't, if you look at mainstream government and politics and society in America, you know, 75% fall in that mainstream. And as
we
as public officials and the media and society in general can begin to bring us back to that mainstream and avoid us being dragged to the ultra-left or the ultra-right, that's where,
mm-hmm.
you know, we common ground, we can put aside the division, put aside the polarization, and really realize as a society, there has to be give and takes. You know, you can't as a country, as a society, as a people, you know, take away totally from someone or disenfranchise someone completely. That's going to cause hurt feelings, going to cause
mm-hmm.
anger. But we're witnessing. That's why at the end of the day, you know, my philosophy and my campaign and my advocacy is mainstream. And when people were attacking law enforcement, I was one of the few public officials that took a strong stand and said, hey, you got to fund police, you got to support police, you got to make sure you address the issues, and that the issues is more training, more visibility, more compliance, more transparency. I'm all for
mm-hmm.
that. And I put funding where it matters. I brought funding to train police and train law enforcement in Yonkers. And that's my answer. My answer is, find solutions. If there's a weakness, acknowledge it. Don't try to hide it. Don't try to be blindsided by the
mm-hmm.
rhetoric that is from every side. Address it. Address it. You know, put the tools there. Put the resources there. And when I see that positive changes taking place as a result, and we look at, you know, positive changes in my neighborhood and really statewide, you know, that's where it becomes feasible. That's where you can look at a track record and say, you know what, you know, we're addressing the issue, we're addressing the problem. And that's what it's all about, Hezzy. You know, too often
absolutely
we caught up in rhetoric.
Well, I wanted to ask you before you leave, because we only have like a minute or two, how do people reach out if they want to support your candidacy? As you run for re-election, where do they go?
Well, you know what? I really appreciate that. You know, tomorrow we have the headquarters. People that want to support our re-election, you know, can reach out to our campaign headquarters, which is at 10 Palisade Avenue. That's where my law office is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the number
mm-hmm.
here, always call. And they can always leave a message, their name, and somebody from the campaign will get back to them. It's 914-423-0800. If you call, that's the law office. I spent some time here. They can, of course, call, leave their name. This way I always separate the politics from the assembly office.
Mm-hmm.
And we keep it professional. But campaign is crucial. Getting volunteers, getting people that may say, you know what, Sage, I like your agenda. I like what you've done the last 3.5-4 years. You know, you deserve to be reelected November 8th. You know what? Give me a sign. I want to put a sign on my business, a sign on my lawn.
Well,
I want to volunteer. I want to make some calls on your behalf. You know, that's what it takes. I have a fundraiser on September 20th. It's a Tuesday evening, 6 to 9, at the
mm-hmm.
Castle for the All Paula Center. And, you know, people that want to support that way can attend the event. They can give a call, and, of course, we can send them the information. And that's what a campaign is all about. It's outreach. It's being honest and open-ended with the public at large. And thankfully for me, you know, when I go through at Yonkers, you know, my history, my work, my career has been in Yonkers all my life. Mm-hmm. I work in Yonkers. My 40 years of involvement as an educator, as a school principal for 30-plus years, as the president of the Board of Education, you know, I've met so many individuals that tell me, Sage, you are my principal, or you are my kid's principal, or you gave me a high school diploma at graduation, or I know your brothers from medicine. Thankfully, my family's been in healthcare for many years and have nose treated so many patients. And, you know, so, or my law practice, you know, my clients or people I've represented and helped for years. You know, so I wear, thankfully, many hats. I've been involved, served on so many community-based agencies, chairman of the Parking Authority, president of the Board of Education, so many cultural, civic, governmental groups over the years. You know, so before my days as an assemblyman, you know, my heart was always into Yonkers, into how do we make our community better, how we promote it, how do we make it more positive for us. I'm a homeowner, I'm a family man. I know the cost of living in Yonkers. I pay my taxes. I know the cost of paying water bills and mortgages and everything else. So, you know, so I look at it, you know, and I understand what people go through. And for people that tell me, well, you know, do you know what the immigrants go through or the people that are disenfranchised? And I often tell them, I understand it. I grew up in Southwest Yonkers. I shined shoes as a kid to pay my school lunch. So I tell people, look, I understand, you know, and that's why in our legislation, in our constituent services and everything I try to do, you know, I try to be, you know, open-ended. I try to be broad-minded. Mm-hmm. I reflect and understand the people that are reaching out, what they're going through, what they're impacted by, and how can we change it? I don't want to just listen to people tell me what their problems. I want to at the same time say, well, somebody's telling me what a problem they have. What can I do? What can I do to bring about change, positive change? Like something as simple as the doctor bill. I mean, that was something that people spoke and complained, and I said, you know what? Why is there taxes on diapers? Why, you know, people that claim, you know, as simple as feminine products that were being charged more than they should. You know, we passed legislation, gender equality, we passed legislation, you know, funding for education for SUNY, State University, CUNY, the City University. We passed funding and legislation and made it easier for everyone to afford colleges. That's the type of thing that, you know, you look at a track record, and that's what you gauge a public official. As we said earlier when we opened the show, for all the listeners, that's what you look at. You look at a person's track record. You look at their background. You look at their initiative. Are they effective with constituent services? Are they effective as leaders? Because part of the role that I play as a state representative, and the assembly is basically the people's house. The assembly is where legislation takes place. If it goes to the assembly first, then it goes to the Senate, and if it passes there, it goes to the governor, and the governor signs off on it, it becomes state law. That's the process. So I tell individuals all the time, if you have an issue, bring it up. Let us know. And very often I encourage people, well, if you have an issue, what do you think would fix it? I want to hear their solutions. I want to hear their recommendations. And very often that's what I would propose in changing. You know, people that complained about drag racing on Central Avenue and elsewhere, we put legislation. There's a bill up in Albany that would increase penalties and really focus on decreasing drag racing. Sometimes family members can be driving on Central Avenue elsewhere, and you got some crazies that are drag racing. I mean, sometimes, how many times across our state and nation, innocent people get killed and hurt because people are careless on the road, you know, drinking and driving or other dangers, you know, driving and operating under the influence. There's a lot of concerns where if you're proactive and you put forth meaningful legislation, whether it's your mm-hmm. own, in my case, supporting other legislation, and in my nearly 4 years, I got to say, whether my own or other legislation, I've signed on and supported nearly 3,000 legislative pieces, 3,000. And, you know, that's a testament to activity, a testament to responsibility, a testament to yeah. commitment. And that's what we should look for in our public officials.
Mm. Well, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for making the time for our audience. And thank you for revealing your effort for re-election. And give us the phone number again one last time before we go.
Phone number, anything dealing with the campaign is the law offices of Nader Sayed, which is the headquarters for Friends of Nader Sayed, and it's 914-423-0800. That's the law office. Please call, give your name, your contact information, and we'll have someone from the campaign reach out and see how we can work together. And again, most appreciate. And before we go, again on
yes,
the show
sir.
That's wanted mm-hmm. to give our deep sympathy on the passing of Queen Elizabeth II. It's amazing, seven days. And wish the very best for King Charles now as he ascends to the throne. And mm-hmm. also condolences, you know, to realize yesterday we lost Bernard Shaw, CNN's first chief anchor. And I remember him during the Gulf War in 1991.
Yeah, good people.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
But that, as we appreciate the opportunity and always look forward
you,
to our little chats. And thank you to
be
the
well.
Audience.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Stay healthy. Be healthy. Bye. Well, there we are, folks. None other than Nader Sayed, who's running for re-election. He's running for the New York State Assembly. He's already an assembly member. He's running for re-election, and he represents 85% of Yonkers. I think he's the only assembly member that represents only one community, Yonkers itself. And the other part, the other last 15% of Yonkers is represented by Gary Pretlow, who also represents all of Mount Vernon, I think. So he represents two communities, but Nader Sayed, I think, is the only one who represents one community. Really just fascinating. Well, let's talk about a lot of other things that are really, really fascinating with regard to a profile of, for example, Prince Charles, who has now become Britain's longest ever king in waiting, but he is now regarded as King Charles III. Fascinating. Well, Prince Charles, the heir to the British throne, became King Charles III with Queen Elizabeth's passing. Charles is 73. He's waited decades to ascend to the British throne. He's the eldest of Queen Elizabeth's four children and has been first in line to the throne all his life. The Prince of Wales' highly publicized marriage to Lady Diana the couple's messy divorce and her tragic death has largely defined his public persona, but in recent years, he has tried to restore his image. He has been preparing for this role his entire life. As the eldest of Queen Elizabeth's children, he has been in line to the throne for 70 years, a record in the royal family. When he was born on the November 14, 1948, his mother was not yet queen. It was not until 4 years later when his grandfather, King George VI, died of a coronary thrombosis that Elizabeth ascended to the throne. The following year, the young Charles attended his mother's coronation at Westminster Abbey. After growing up in Buckingham Palace alongside his siblings Anne, Andrew, and Edward, Charles was the first to go to school just like any royal subject according to his mother's wishes. He attended Gordonston School, a regular boarding school in northeast Scotland, the same institution his father, the Duke of Edinburgh, had gone to as a child. Charles did not have fond memories of the school. He went on to study at Cambridge University, where he earned a degree in anthropology, archaeology, and history, making him the first British monarch with a university degree. At the age of 21 in 1969, Charles was officially named the Duke of Cornwall, the title reserved for the oldest male heir of the sovereign. His mother crowned him Prince of Wales at a ceremony that was broadcast on national television. After university, Charles joined the Royal Navy, where he served as an officer for 5 years from 1971 to 1976. He also earned his helicopter pilot's license. And it's a fairy tale marriage that turned sour. During his youth, the prince was known for his dalliances with several women from well-to-do families. In 1981, at the age of 32, he finally decided to marry Lady Diana Spencer, who was 20 years old and from the British aristocracy. More than 750 million people watched the wedding on television channels around the world. The couple had two sons, William, born in 1982, and Harry in 1984. But the fairy tale turned into a nightmare a few years later. The couple separated in 1992, shortly after Diana revealed that her husband had a long-standing extramarital affair with Camilla Parker Bowles, one of his childhood sweethearts. For several years, the princess and the Prince of Wales could no longer hide their disagreements. Charles's image was heavily tarnished. The divorce was officially announced in 1996. A year later, on August 31st of 1997, Diana was killed in a car accident under the Alma Bridge in Paris, along with her boyfriend at the time, Dodi Al-Fayed. The news sent shockwaves around the world. Prince Charles traveled to France to retrieve the body of his ex-wife. The heir to the throne, to the crown rather, appeared to be very close with his sons as he took part in the national funeral, walking behind Lady Di's coffin. Well, Charles, long perceived as an unfaithful husband, tried to restore his image. 8 years after Diana's tragic death, he finally married his greatest love, Camilla Parker Bowles. Passionate about botany and gardening, he maintains his reputation as an environmental enthusiast and sponsors several environmental associations. In 2007, he notably created the Prince's Rainforest Project to raise awareness of deforestation. He's also the president of the World Wildlife Fund, the WWF, in the United Kingdom. He started an organic farm and garden at his huge country estate, Highgrove Gardens. He also campaigns for organic farming. While waiting to become king, Charles carried out many responsibilities within the monarchy. On behalf of the Queen, he officiated at official openings and attended the funerals of foreign dignitaries. In 2013, he represented his mother for the first time at a meeting of the Commonwealth heads of government. In 2022, for the first time, and because Elizabeth II was experiencing health issues, Charles delivered the Queen's speech at the traditional opening ceremony of Parliament. Considered eccentric and quirky, Charles often found himself engulfed in controversy. In 2005, during the funeral of Pope John II, he aroused controversy by shaking hands with Zimbabwean dictator Robert Mugabe. 10 years later, letters made public and addressed to members of Tony Blair's government revealed some interference by the heir to the throne in political affairs, which contradicts the tradition of royal family neutrality. In 2017, he was also hit by the Paradise Papers scandal, which revealed that Charles, who manages his own private funds, invested around 3.5 million euros offshore in the Cayman Islands. Last July, Charles found himself in the midst of yet another controversy as he was accused of accepting €1 million from members of Osama bin Laden's family for his charity. His popularity then dropped from 50 to 42%, far behind his eldest son, William, according to the polling institute YouGov, Y-O-U-G-O-V. The new sovereign chose the name of Charles III, even though his first name, Charles, is considered a curse in British history. In the absence of his mother and in spite of his unpopularity, Charles will nonetheless have to keep the crown afloat. His reign will also be much shorter than his mother's, giving him little time to leave his mark. Fascinating, to say the least. Now, let's look at some other issues relating to this, the demise of the Queen. Popular Prince William now becomes heir to the throne. Heir to the throne now that his father has become king, Prince William has stepped up to royal duties after the exit of his brother Harry and Uncle Andrew. William has grown up with a strong sense of his future responsibilities. With Charles's reign inevitably set to be shorter than that of his mother, Queen Elizabeth II, and as the new king ages, William will have a much more visible public profile, preparing for his later role as king, said Robert Hazel, professor of government and the constitution at University College in London. William will have to undertake more of the load, so I have no doubt that there will be an increasing share of royal duty that William will assume. Now, William, who's 40, has so far managed to carve a life largely out of the spotlight, taking on military and civilian jobs, and as a hands-on father of three with his wife, Catherine, proving popular with the public. They are known as the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, and now after the Queen's death, also as the Duke and Duchess of Cornwall. The couple have become prominent campaigners for mental health. They have also advocated for protecting the environment and conservation, showing a more modern face to the ancient institution. Quote, I think that most people think that William and Kate will make a great team and be a great king and queen, said Phil Dampier, a royal author. Well, from his birth on June 21 of 1982, William Arthur Philip Lewis Mountbatten Windsor was destined to be king. Harry the Spare, quote-unquote, to William's heir, quote unquote, came along 2 years later. But both boys were treated the same in terms of education, with nannies and then boarding school from the age of 8. He was just 10 when his parents separated, leading to their divorce in 1996, and was 15 when his mother, Princess Diana, was killed in a car crash in 1997. An enduring image of the young boys was at their mother's funeral, when they walked heads bowed through the streets of London behind her funeral cortege to Westminster Abbey. The brothers have always spoken warmly of their mother, and as a young man, William, with his blonde hair, bore a striking resemblance to her, earning him pin-up status. And William once recalled his mother singing along to Tina Turner's hit Simply the Best in the car to raise their mood as they returned to a new term of school. He also jumped to her defense when a 2021 inquiry found the BBC had tricked her into agreeing to a bombshell 1995 television interview where she admitted adultery. He has also not been afraid to speak his mind and answered tersely when asked about Brother Harry's claims of royal racism. Quote, we are very much not a racist family, end quote, he told reporters. William has yet to respond publicly to Harry's claim that he and his father are trapped, quote unquote, by convention. But it is clear he appreciates the need to portray himself as a safe pair of hands to ensure the monarchy's future survival. He has given few in-depth media interviews, and with Catherine, a keen amateur photographer, they have sought to control the narrative through social media. Family's 2021 Christmas card showed their relaxed style, posing in a desert landscape in Jordan, with William and Catherine's hands casually placed on each other's knees. He has given snippets of his eclectic taste in music, ranging from English band Coldplay to Australian hard rock band AC/DC. While at the prestigious Eton School, he declared a love for Aston Villa, choosing the unfashionable Birmingham club because he, quote, wanted to have a team that was more mid-table that could give me more emotional roller coaster moments, end quote. He became a president. He became president of the Football Association in 2006 and has been a regular at England's games, but also participates in upper-class pursuits such as polo and grouse shooting. William and then Kate Middleton first met at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, and their relationship blossomed after he spotted her modeling at a student fashion show. While Harry became known as a party prince, William forged a more wholesome image. The couple married in 2011. William became a Royal Air Force search and rescue helicopter pilot for 3 years, living in a farmhouse in rural northwest Wales with Kate and their first child, George. Now, the family then moved to Norfolk in eastern England, where William took on a civilian role of air ambulance pilot in 2015. He has said also involved traumatic experiences trying to help people who were, quote, at death's door, end quote. 2017, William left his job to become a full-time royal, shuttling between London and Norfolk, where they have a home on the sprawling royal estate in Sandringham. During the coronavirus lockdown, William said he and Kate shared schooling duties of their two eldest children, George and Charlotte, and their struggles with basic maths. William's enhanced profile developed after the Queen's health declined. Harry quit royal life, and their uncle was stripped of his role due to a U.S. civil case for sexual assault that he eventually settled out of court. my God, there's so much to know about these people. It's just amazing. 1 second. And this is interesting with regard to the elderly King Charles III, who is going to, 1 second, bear with me a moment. Okay, the elderly King Charles III faces testing times. Trained from childhood to be king, Charles III has endured the longest wait for the throne in history. I forgot I have already read this for you. So, 1 second. No, I didn't finish this. I'm sorry. It's just similar in my mind. So, trained from childhood to be king, Charles III has endured the longest wait for the throne in British history. But while his mother, Queen Elizabeth II, was crowned in 1953 with huge fanfare and national excitement, aged just 25, her aging eldest son will attract less enthusiasm, royal commentators have said. It will be very difficult for him in terms of following the queen, quote-unquote, Robert Hazel, who founded the Constitution Unit at University College London, advised. The monarchy is likely to go through, I think, some testing times. Born in 1948, Charles married Diana Spencer in 1981, and they had two sons, William and Harry, before their marriage fell apart amid very public revelations of infidelities. Diana died at a high-speed car crash in Paris in 1997, age 36. And in 2005, Charles married his divorced long-term lover, Camilla Parker Bowles. The new king has long been known for his outspoken comments on topics of modernist architecture and often faced mockery and accusations of meddling, even if his environmental concerns have now become mainstream. As king, he will have to change to be, quote, scrupulously neutral, end quote, said Hazel. In a 2018 BBC interview, Charles made it clear he understood he would have to stop his public campaigning. I'm not that stupid, he said. But neutrality could prove difficult. As Scottish nationalists push for another referendum on independence while saying it will keep the monarchy, said Hazel. It would be, quote, very difficult, quote, unquote, for the monarchy to remain scrupulously neutral throughout the referendum campaign, unquote. At the same time, Hazel praised Charles' quote, very strong sense of public service and public duty, unquote. I think that will carry him in very good stead when he becomes king. Opinion polling by YouGov shows the prospects of Charles as monarch divide British public opinion almost equally. In 2022, just under a third of respondents said he would not make a good king, while almost exactly the same proportion said he would. I don't expect that to change much when he becomes king, said Hazel. By contrast, over 80% say the queen has done a fairly good job on or very good job. Britain is a constitutional monarchy with a king or queen as head of state. Support for a republic has stood at around 15% in the last 2 years. Sensing a changing mood, the pressure group Republic began a billboard campaign in mid-2021 calling for the abolition of the monarchy. Republic's chief executive Graham Smith said that Charles's accession would be a major turning point, quote unquote, with Barbados having ditched the monarchy as head, as head of state in November of 2021, raising the prospect that others may follow suit. Quote, it's not going to be 1952 all over again, end quote, he added, referring to the Queen's accession on the death of her father, King George VI. Quote, he's not protected by the almost impenetrable shield of deference that surrounds the Queen, end quote. By contrast, quote, Charles has had a lifetime of being criticized, being lampooned, end quote, he added. Hazel suggested there may be pressure on Charles to abdicate in favor of his son William, born in 1982, and he could conceivably do so unlike his mother. Belgium King Albert stood down in 2013 at the age of 79 in favor of his son, as did Juan Carlos I of Spain the following year. For Smith, however, Charles, quote, is not going to give up, end quote. With public scrutiny of royal finances increasing, Charles reportedly wants to reduce the number of royals on official duty, now around a dozen. Several other European royal families have done this already. However, numbers have fallen lately, with Prince Harry moving to California and Charles's brother Prince Andrew stepping down because of a furor over his friendship with the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Limiting royal roles is not primarily about saving money, but reducing the risk that one of them will go off the rails, Hazel said. Yet this would reduce the numbers available to attend public events, he conceded. Harry's wife, Meghan, complained in a sensational Oprah Winfrey interview that the couple's son, Archie, had not received the title prince, quote unquote. She linked this to slimming down, but also said that one or more royal had made racist remarks before Archie's birth. There's been no change that I know of to the rules. There's been no discrimination against Harry, Hazel had said. At the same time, Charles will be able to choose on titles, for example, including whether to make William the Prince of Wales, that he held since 1958, Hazel continued to say. Ultimately, it's the choice of the monarch whether to confer a title. Now, the Sun tabloid reported that Charles does not plan to make his youngest brother, Edward, the Duke of Edinburgh, even though it was his late father's wish. But in one of her last decisive acts over the succession, the Queen settled the issue about what Charles's wife, Camilla, will be called, giving her blessing for Queen Consort, quote unquote. And that was a big move by the Queen. Bear with me a moment. Now, one second here. Let me move over to let's look at some other issues that you may find compelling. There's a debate that's flaring up over in Spain over bull running fiestas as 10 people have died. Spain's controversial bull running festivals have once again hit the headlines after a deadly summer in which at least 10 people lost their lives, exacerbating divisions over the centuries-old tradition. 7 deaths occurred in the eastern Valencia region, where the practice of releasing bulls into the streets for entertainment has sparked debate, with the other fatalities taking place in the regions of Madrid, Castilla y León, and Navarra in the north. This year's toll raises to more than 30 the total number of people who have been killed in Valencia's bull-running events since 2015. This summer's victims, who died from injuries sustained while racing through the streets alongside a group of hefty bulls known as Bulls al Carrer in Valencian, were between the ages of 18 and 73. 6 of them were men, and 1 was a woman, a French woman, who was the
oldest victim. They died after being gored or trampled by the bulls. Countless other people were injured, among them minors. Bull running events are a highlight of summer festivities across Spain, with the best known being the San Fermín Festival in the northern city of Pamplona. The idea is that a small group of bulls are let loose into a fenced-off area of the street, and hundreds of foolhardy thrill-seekers run alongside them for a few adrenaline-fueled minutes in a spectacle that draws thousands of spectators. In Valencia and in southern parts of neighboring Catalonia, such events are hugely popular, and few are the villages that don't put on some sort of entertainment involving bulls barreling through the streets. There are also bus a la mar, races to the seafront, where at the end of the run, the participants make the bulls fall into the water, most ending up bare themselves. Experts are divided about when the practice of running the bulls began, but Cuellar, I don't know if that's pronounced correctly, a city town or a town some 150 kilometers or about 90 miles north of Madrid, decided it will, experts are divided about when the practice of running the bulls began, but Cuellar, a town some 150 kilometers or about 90 miles north of Madrid, claims to have historical records dating back to the 13th century. And although the exact origin of the tradition is unclear, it's thought to have emerged out of the need to bring bulls from the countryside into the towns on market day, when they would be corralled through the streets with sticks. Irrespective of how it began, it has become a political hot potato for the local authorities, which often sparks heated debate and can win or lose an election. When the socialists and their hard left ally Podemos managed to take over Valencia's regional government in 2015, ousting the right-wing Popular Party, they were careful to steer well clear of the issue. Podemos, which in Valencia is known as Compromís, is implacably opposed to any entertainment involving bulls. Quote, it's not a simple issue whether debating or legislating. There are many sensitivities, Valencia's regional deputy leader, Aitana Mas, told reporters. At some point, it's a debate which we have to have, said Mas of the Compromís party, referring to a ban on all such activities. Quote, we're talking about seven lives this summer alone, she said. But adding it was also necessary to talk about protecting animals. German Zarazoga, or Hermann Zarazoga, head of the region's fundraiser, So Hermann Zaragoza, the head of the region's Federation of Bullfighting Clubs, which promotes bullfighting events as the Spain's, quote, most traditional and authentic fiestas, end quote, says any such move would face an uphill battle. They will have to take on Valencia's love for the bus al carrer, he said. The right to access culture and all events featuring bulls are absolutely part of that. It's sacred within the Constitution, he said in a statement. And neither the city councils nor the regions have the authority to ban or organize a referendum on the fate of such events. The right-wing Popular Party, which has a long history of supporting any bull-related festivities, pledged its support for such traditional events. And those who question the validity of such fiestas, quote, are attacking who we are and such how we are and such how we express our tradition and culture, said Mata Baraquina, a local Popular Party leader in Valencia. But not all areas of Valencia feel the same, with towns like Sueca or Tavernes de la Valigina refusing to issue bull running events as, quote, torture, dressed up as culture and tradition in which abuse is more than evident. And such spectacles often involve these noble animals being beaten with sticks, kicked, jerked around, insulted, humiliated, and subjected to stress, it states. And the runners, quote, are often drunk or under the influence of drugs, with many also injured. So far, the petition has garnered some 5,500 signatures. So we'll see where all that goes. My goodness. Now, let's see what else is happening here. Bear with me a moment. One second. All right. Wanted to check something else out. Bear with me a moment here. Okay, this is really quite interesting as well. I think you may find it interesting, at least I hope so. The question becomes, where did the Queen's fortune come from? Her collection of jewels and vast estates may have been impressive, but Queen Elizabeth II's wealth paled in comparison with other royals. She was estimated to be worth £370 million. It's more than $420 million, not quite enough to earn her a spot on the Sunday Times 2022 rich list of the United Kingdom's 250 wealthiest. And her fortune was dwarfed by that of other monarchs. Thai royal families' wealth is estimated at between $50 and $70 billion, while Saudi King Salman has a reported net worth of $18 billion. So how did she make her money, and how did she spend it? Well, the taxpayer funds the British monarch's lifestyle, while they and the royal family also receive income from gigantic private holdings, the details of which are not fully known. An annual allowance from the government called the sovereign grant covered the Queen's official expenses and those of the royals representing her. In the financial year 2020 to 2021, this amounted to almost £86 million. That's including £34.4 million toward ongoing renovations at Buckingham Palace in London. The sovereign grant is set an equivalent set as an equivalent to 15% of the profits of the Crown estate, a huge portfolio of land, property, and other assets, such as wind farms that belong to the ruling monarch but is independently managed. The Crown estate's net income is handed to the Treasury under an agreement sealed in 1760. The sovereign grant was temporarily increased to cover the extensive updating work on Buckingham Palace. It is and also used to pay hundreds of staff working for the royal household. Now, the Privy Purse is the name for the monarch's private income, which mainly comes from the Duchy of Lancaster estate, owned by the monarchy since the Middle Ages. Its assets include land, financial investments, and property that are worth more than £500 million. The estate is made up of 315 residential properties, as well as commercial properties in central London and thousands of acres or hectares of agricultural land. Its 2020 to 2021 net operating income was more than £20 million. The Queen gave part of this to her relatives and paid tax on the amount that was not spent on official duties. The Queen uses that money to pay for her own overheads to run Balmoral and Sandringham, which are very expensive, said David McClure, author of a book on the monarch's finances. The Queen's true worth, quote unquote, both properties were owned by the Queen herself. She also uses some of the money to cross-subsidize other members of the royal family who don't get money from the public grant or sovereign grant, McClure had said. And these recipients include her daughter, Princess Anne, the oldest, or rather youngest son, Prince Edward, and his wife, Sophie, the Countess of Wessex, as well as her second son, Prince Andrew. Andrew is no longer carrying out royal duties and therefore is not expected to be receiving an allowance as generous as in the past. He is in disgrace over his relationship with the late U.S. financier Jeffrey Epstein, a convicted pedophile who killed himself in jail in 2019. While most of the royal palaces are owned by the Crown estate, the Queen owned two privately, Balmoral Castle in Scotland, with an estimated worth of about £100 million, pounds, and Sandringham Country Estate, worth about £50 million pounds, and they are not publicly funded. The Queen also privately owned some items in the royal collection, including a stamp collection that belonged to her grandfather, King George V, valued at £100 million. The Queen's passion for racing horses also earned her more than £7 million in prize money, according to estimates by MyRacing.com, although this included their costly upkeep. Crown jewels, which have been valued at some £3 billion, symbolically belong to the Queen but are automatically transferred to her successor. Queen was implicated in the Paradise Papers, formerly secret documents leaked in 2017, exposing interests held offshore by the rich and powerful as a means of tax avoidance. The documents were released by the U.S.-based International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, the ICIJ. Well, they said the Queen had, through the Duchy of Lancaster, placed around £10 million in funds held in the Cayman Islands in Bermuda, British overseas territories that are considered to be tax havens. Well, the question is it not that rich? Well, with a fortune of £370 million, the Queen did not make the Sunday Times 2022 rich list of the 250 wealthiest. taught by moguls, Sri and Gopi Hinduja, who oversee a vast business empire and are estimated to be worth more than 28 billion pounds. Entrepreneur James Dyson and his family climbed to second place with a wealth estimate of 23 billion pounds. And former Finance Minister Rishi Sunak and his Indian wife, Akshata Murthy, however, did make the list for the first time when their joint 730 million pound with their 730 million pound fortune. So that's really, really very compelling for sure. And it's interesting to know, at least I hope you found it interesting to know. Bear with me a moment here as I look at one last thing before we'll probably sign off. Bear with me a moment here. All right, let's just look here. I have to catch up on all these articles. Let me just quickly see this. Let's quickly go through this and then we'll end the our broadcast. Queen Elizabeth II notched up a number of landmarks during her record-breaking 70 years on the throne. Longevity. Elizabeth reigned for 70 years and nearly 4 months, longer than any other monarch in British history. The previous record was held by her great-great-grandmother, Queen Victoria, who reigned for 63 years, 7 months, and 2 days until 1901. Until her death on Thursday at the age of 96, Elizabeth was the oldest current monarch and head of state in the world. Only two monarchs have ruled for longer, Francis Louis XIV, more than 72 years between 1643 and 1715, and Thailand's Birinbol Abdulyadej, 70 years and 4 months until his death in October of 2016. The Queen traveled to more than 100 countries since 1952, another record for a British monarch, and made more than 150 visits to Commonwealth nations. She went to Canada 22 times, more than any other country. In Europe, she visited France the most often, 13 times, and spoke the French language fluently. The Daily Telegraph calculated that she traveled the equivalent of 42 times across the world before stopping overseas trips in November of 2015 at the age of 89. The longest foreign trip lasted 168 days from November of 1953 to May of 1954, during which she visited 13 countries. As a 21-year-old princess, Elizabeth pledged her life to the service of the Commonwealth. As queen, she carried out some 21,000 engagements, gave royal assent to 4,000 pieces of legislation, and hosted 112 state visits of foreign heads of state. Among those she hosted were Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia in 1954, Japan's Emperor Hirohito in 1971, President Lech Walesa of Poland in 1991, Barack Obama in 2011. More than 180 garden parties had been hosted by Buckingham Palace, or rather at Buckingham Palace, attended by more than 1.5 million people. A total of 15 British prime ministers served under the Queen. The first was Winston Churchill, 1952 to 55, and the last was Liz Truss, who was appointed only on Tuesday, and she held regular private meetings with her prime minister of the day, usually at Buckingham Palace on a weekly basis. Elizabeth II met 13 out of the last 14 U.S. presidents, with the exception of Lyndon B. Johnson. Her last visit from the White House was with Joe Biden in 2021. The Queen was the Supreme Governor of the Church of England, a position dating back to the creation of the Church under Henry VIII in the 16th century. She met four popes on official visits: John the 23rd in 1961, John Paul II in 1980, 1982, and 2000, Benedict the 16th in 2010, and Francis the 1st in 2014. The Queen sent them 300,000 cards of congratulations to centenarians and more than 900,000 to couples celebrating 60 years of marriage. She was married for 73 years, another record for a British monarch. Her husband, Prince Philip, died at the age of 99 in April of last year. The Queen posed for more than 200 portraits since the age of 7. Most were painted in a traditional style, but Lucian Freud's portrait painted in 2001 proved controversial. One critic said it made Her Majesty look like one of her corgi dogs. Well, a pioneer. In 1996, the Queen became the first British monarch to visit mainland China. She was also the first to address the House of Representatives in Washington. She sent her first email on March 26 of 1976 during a visit to a Ministry of Defense research facility. And in 1997, she launched the Buckingham Palace website, and in 2014 sent her first tweet. 3 years ago, she made her debut on Instagram. The Queen is the only monarch to have jumped out of a helicopter with James Bond and parachuted into the opening ceremony of the Olympics, kind of. She and her beloved corgis made a cameo appearance at the 2012 London Games with 007 actor Daniel Craig before a stunt person made the leap. And so you have it. What a breathtaking history. Absolutely stunning, stunning life. And she created something almost untouchable by any other royal, no matter where they happen to be. Absolutely breathtaking. Well, today's Friday. Wish you a great weekend. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks again to Assemblymember Neda Sej, representing the 90th Assembly District, which is comprised only of Yonkers. And have a great weekend, and we'll speak to you on Monday. All the best, and goodbye.